Blog Talk Radio.
This is an Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash production.
Into another fantabulous episode of the Take It Easy radio show live here on a lovely Wednesday, March 24th. My name is Kyle, and I will be rolling with you for the next hour here live on Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash. Our ultimate dream scenario today is that we get some live breaking news coming in on the show. Tomorrow, we will be back and at it again during the NBA trade deadline. We are within 24 hours of said deadline. The deadline will pass at 3 p.m. Eastern time tomorrow. We will be on the air at 4 p.m. Eastern, and I can guarantee you that even though there will not be any league-shattering moves that go down within the next 24 hours, we will still talk about all of the NBA madness going on here on the Take It Easy radio show, because last time we were on the air searching for breaking news was our season preview, or I'm sorry, our season premiere, when the James Harden news broke live on the air and me and Martez were scrambling for information and filling time. So that was by far our most popular episode of the year. It's the most popular episode I've ever done on the radio show. Podcasts get pretty close, but podcasts don't have the breaking news element to it. So it was totally new territory for me. And I hope that today or tomorrow we can get some breaking news to react to. But in the meantime, unless we can break into some news, we've got some interesting stuff planned out for today. I want to talk about this NBA trade deadline, what could be coming, what could not. One team in particular and one player in particular intrigued me, and I wanted to get to that at some point here today. Also, this will be a topic for tomorrow's podcast, but there is a really in-depth investigative story done by ESPN around Jared Goff and Sean McVay. We're going to read a little bit at some point today, time permit. It was written by Lindsay Thyrie. I hope I got her last name right. But Lindsay wrote a fantastic piece detailing what ended up happening between Jared Goff, Sean McVay, the Los Angeles Rams, which, you know, 16 months removed from a contract extension that I was disappointed was signed at the time, 16 months removed, all of a sudden, Jared Goff was traded to the Detroit Lions. So we'll dip into that a little bit later on in the show. I spent an hour reading, diving into, writing about that story, so wanted to touch on that a little bit today. But first, we mentioned it off the top, NBA trade deadline. Let's get right into it. This is the list I have, like the official, unofficial list of trade deadline names coming up within 24 hours of the NBA trade deadline, a month later than usual. But here is the, as is pretty much the whole NBA schedule, by the way, but here are the official, unofficial names that can, should, might, or can, should, will, might, or be bought out before the NBA trade deadline. So first of all, here are the players who will be moved within the next 24 hours. Otherwise, the franchises are just not doing right by their teams, or not doing right by their organization, really, if they keep these players past the trade deadline. And to be honest, I think the reason some of these names haven't been moved is only because we're waiting to get as close to the deadline as possible so you can field last-minute offers And I expect at some point tomorrow a flurry of moves will start to come in from these certain – from these particular teams and these particular players. So here are the players who will 100% – well, 100% should be moved tomorrow under rational circumstances. Victor Oladipo, J.J. Redick, George Hill, Nemanja Bjelica, Evan Fournier, and Norman Powell. Those are people who should be 100% moved before tomorrow if their organizations are doing right. Where did this come from? The list is players on expiring contracts, teams with no chance of competing in the playoffs, and they will be entering some sort of unrestricted free agency where they're going to leave their current teams. Therefore, the teams are gaining nothing by keeping them on the roster. They may be able to flip it even for pennies on the dollar. It's better than nothing, given that these players are headed out the door. And for simple reasons, J.J. Redick, Pelicans are the 11th seed right now. They have younger players who replicate J.J. Redick's playing style, not that they're putting up the production, but maybe Kyra Lewis and Nikhil Alexander-Walker should be getting some minutes there for the New Orleans Pelicans. And J.J. Redick is on an expiring contract, as I mentioned, so he may be out the door at the end of the season anyways. Lots of people want a J.J. Redick. Move him at all costs. Evan Fournier, same situation. Contract expires at the end of the season. Orlando is in a really bad position. He should be moved before the trade deadline. His price tag may be larger for Orlando, and maybe they want to re-sign him, but it doesn't make sense for Orlando to not get at least something for Evan Fournier at this point. Bjelica, same situation, expiring contract. Kings suck. George Hill, I don't believe George Hill has an expiring contract, but everyone wants a George Hill, and they might just buy him out if he doesn't get traded by the deadline. Expiring contract, Toronto Raptors falling apart. We'll get to them in a second. And Victor Oladipo, Rockets already have started the fire sale. They traded P.J. Tucker in the most perfect possible trade that could have been consummated in my imagination before the trade deadline. Tucker goes to the Milwaukee Bucks. The Milwaukee Bucks give Houston their 2022 first-round pick back. 2023 first-round pick goes to the Bucks. So they basically swap picks. The Bucks pick goes back there. The Bucks send their pick back to Houston. I think that's how it works. So the Bucks sent Houston's pick. No, Houston sent the Bucks pick to Milwaukee. The Bucks sent a pick a year later over to Houston. So that's how that trade ends up getting consummated. Perfect trade. Oladipo's next up. He'll be hitting free agency. If he can get pennies on the dollar, get pennies on the dollar for Victor Oladipo, because it's pretty clear that the John Wall, Victor Oladipo, and Christian Wood trio is not going to work out for the Houston Rockets. John Wall will be moved if anyone's willing to take his contract this offseason. Christian Wood will be there for the rebuild in Houston. So get whatever you can for Victor Oladipo. I believe I got through all the names on that list. Then we have the people who may get traded in an unlikely event that a player gets traded, but maybe should be traded, or you can wait till the off season. But if one of these players got moved, it would certainly be interesting at this point. And that consists of Harrison Barnes, Nikola Vukovic, that's a buyout, Terry Rozier, Aaron Gordon, John Collins, Larry Markkanen, Lonzo Ball, and basically everybody on the Sacramento Kings. Basically everyone on the Kings should go. They're on that list. So Harrison Barnes, Vucevic, Terry Rozier, Aaron Gordon, John Collins, Larry Markkanen, and Lonzo Ball. If one of those people get traded tomorrow, it will be pretty much leading our show, which leads us into what I wanted to lead today's show with. Oh, I almost forgot, buyout market. Andre Drummond, he'll get bought out. LaMarcus Aldridge, he'll get bought out. Both of them will go somewhere else. There'll be an array of other buyouts. Corey Joseph, maybe. Thomas Sadoransky, Otto Porter. Those are players that could get bought out. The same situation. You'll have to look at it farther on down the road. What I wanted to talk about today, though, was Kyle Lowry. Because Kyle Lowry is your, 24-hour news cycle guy right now. If you're paying attention to the NBA trade deadline special, Woj just talked about an hour ago before we came on the air that the Lakers are keeping tabs on Kyle Lowry. The Clippers 100% should be keeping tabs on Kyle Lowry. They've been connected to other point guards, but it makes no sense why the Clippers wouldn't keep tabs there. Kyle Lowry has been connected to Miami, as has basically every player available at the trade deadline been connected to Miami. And, of course, the 76ers, where he might ultimately sign next offseason as a free agent. I don't know if the Sixers can work out a deal. It would be like a Danny Green, Tyrese Maxey, and Matisse Thybul swap, which maybe that could work out for the Toronto Raptors. I mean, it's better than nothing is the thing I keep saying. It's better than nothing for the Toronto Raptors. And so Kyle Lowry is interesting, not because he sways the balance of power in the NBA, although just 2 years ago, Kyle Lowry was the second best player on a team that made the NBA championship and won the NBA championship because of Warriors injuries, but was the second best player on a championship team, albeit one of the weaker champions of the last 10 years, but still second best player on a championship team a couple years ago. What makes the Kyle Lowry trade so interesting as you lead up to the deadline is, one, he's potentially the biggest name to be moved at the deadline, but two, legacy factor. And legacy factor is something that you cannot take into account when you're evaluating value based on win shares per 48 minutes or player efficiency rating or points per game swaps between, per se, Kyle Lowry and Goran Dragic or Kyle Lowry and Patrick Beverley. Is that Kyle Lowry is a legacy player for the Toronto Raptors. We are talking about trading a player who will one day have his jersey retired in the Toronto Raptors arena. And this is the difficulty that Toronto possesses right now because, as I said at the start of the year, but I did not think it would be this bad to be fair, the Toronto Raptors are not championship contenders. Not only that, they are struggling to make the playoffs. I thought they would be in that like 6-8 range right now. Now they're on a long losing streak and they've fallen to 11 in the Eastern Conference. But where were they before that losing streak? Fifth in the Eastern Conference. Fifth, sixth, seventh. That's where Toronto was hanging around. So Raptors fans, sorry, not sorry. The run is over. It's done. And you don't need me to tell you that or anyone else who's been following basketball. Toronto's window closed, slammed shut. Toronto knew this was the case because when they lost to LeBron back in 2018, remember that? They were the number one seed. LeBron was a four seed. They beat the Indiana Pacers in seven games, went to Toronto, swept them right out the building. LeBron hit that one-handed buzzer beater off the glass in game three. They went on to get smoked in the championship, or they went on to beat the Terry Rozier Celtics in seven and then went to the championship and got smoked by the Warriors, J.R. Smith game. Anyways, what I want to focus on is Toronto's side of things. When Toronto went down in 2018, everyone looked across the board and said, that team has 1 year left on their championship window because the Toronto Raptors went from team that was hanging around the middle of the pack, eliminated by LeBron in the conference finals in 2016, eliminated in the second round by, I'm trying to remember now, was it Boston that they lost to? Did they lose to Philadelphia? I'm trying to remember now. So Toronto in 2017, did they lose to LeBron in the second round? They may have lost to LeBron in the second round. So Toronto loses then, and 2018, number one seed, best record in the conference, bounced out against the Cavs. So going into the next year, everyone looked around. You're like, you got 1 year left. You went to the conference finals. You got bounced in the second round. You got bounced in the second round. The following year, you got one more shot because soon the natural course of events will take place. DeMar DeRozan will enter his 30s. His play is declining. Kyle Lowry is going to be 33, I believe he was last year. I believe Kyle Lowry might be 34 now, if I am not mistaken. And that is a an issue for the Toronto Raptors. Yeah, he was 33 last season. He's 34 right now. So, well, actually, he turned happy birthday, Kyle Lowry. He turns 35 tomorrow. DeMar DeRozan exiting his prime. Kyle Lowry exiting his prime. Decline of play. Need the young core to replenish. And by the way, this is a great point pointed out by the No Dunks guys. Shout out to them. The Toronto Raptors had a bench unit back in 2018 of Fred VanVleet, Norman Powell, Pascal Siakam, OG Anunoby, and Jakob Poeltl. And all of those guys are now NBA starters, and the bench unit just dissipates for Toronto. So the Raptors, who have gone all in, they have Serge Ibaka, they have obviously Lowry, DeRozan, they fire Coach of the Year, Dwayne Casey. And in that moment, it's an answer of the only ways to upgrade the production on the floor is natural progressions, change the players on the team, or change the coach. Pretty much the only ways, and changing the players on the floor is more dramatic than changing the coach. And Masai Ujiri recognized this same thing. Why? Because if I can recognize it, Masai Ujiri can recognize it, that your window is closing and you got to do something very particular. And so what he did was he determined the window by trading for Kawhi Leonard. And trading for Kawhi Leonard, who was entering free agency the following year, basically said, we are going for it. We are going for the championship right here, right now. We're maximizing our championship window right now because we're changing the coach. We're changing the roster. We don't have a lot of natural progression, we think, but we can change the roster and change the coach, and that's how we're moving forward. The natural progression ends up being Pascal Siakam later on in the season. But anyway, so we know they go to the playoffs, number two seed, seven-game series with the Sixers, Kawhi double-doink winner, beat the Bucks in six games after you lose the first two. So almost a clean sweep, game through six. Go to the finals, Kevin Durant gets hurt, you win the championship, hoorah, Toronto gets the title. Your window closed right after that because Kawhi Leonard left. And when Kawhi Leonard left, all that was left for the Toronto Raptors was Kyle Lowry and a max contract for Pascal Siakam. So you have the number two and the number three from a team that was barely won the championship as a byproduct of injury. Last year, the Toronto Raptors significantly overachieved. I think it's why, if I remember correctly, Nick Nurse won Coach of the Year last year. That finished in the East. Then the pandemic. And then the natural progression started to set in for the Toronto Raptors. Because we saw when the Raptors got to the bubble, yes, they're a two seed, but they are not better than the Boston Celtics. And the Boston Celtics are not better than the Miami Heat. And yes, the Heat beat Milwaukee Bucks. I guarantee you that the Toronto Raptors would have lost to the Miami Heat, would have lost to the Milwaukee Bucks, and would have lost. They did lose to the Boston Celtics. Albeit they took it to seven, but they were down to took a buzzer beater by OG Anunoby them in the series. That kind of definition of the Raptors scrapping their way back. You know, at the very last moment, Leonard is going to keep you afloat. You go all in, you scrap your way back to the top. Now have the longest playoff streak in the NBA after being totally irrelevant for a guy for about 20 years of existence. Isn't that kind of the definition of the Toronto Raptors and their way they go back? Well, now you're the best team. Only are the fourth best team in the East. Well, over the offseason, you're not going to, you know, make major improvements to the roster. Sure, you brought back Fleet, and that's a good move, but you're not going to make major improvements to the roster. It's pretty much the same team coming back with a few natural progressions, even though Pascal Siakam is not the max we thought he would be. He looks like the third best player on a championship team player. What did that do for the Cavs post-Kevin Love? Or post LeBron and Kyrie, well, yeah, they kind of fell off the face of the earth when Kevin Love becomes your best player. So, Kyle Lowry, Pascal Siakam, Norman Powell, and OG Anunoby, you replace him with Danny Green, and Danny Green leaves, but Anunoby didn't play in the playoffs. You have to replicate Kawhi Leonard's production, but it's not sustainable to replicate Kawhi's production with $30 million to Lowry, $15 million to Norman Powell, $33 million to Siakam, another $10 million to OG Anunoby. Like, it's not a sustainable model. This is why the max contract exists in the NBA. It's like it's easier to be Toronto, who gives $32 million to Kawhi Leonard for one season, than the $80 million they're committing to those four players who are replicating Kawhi Leonard's production. Lo and behold, not only were you the fourth best team in the East last year, now the Brooklyn Nets get Kevin Durant back and trade for James Harden. So now they're number one. And, oh, by the way, the Philadelphia 76ers are going to replace their coach, replace their GM, change the roster up all completely around Embiid and Ben Simmons and just race right past you guys. So now you're sixth in the Eastern Conference. But wait a minute. Oh, now all of a sudden, because Siakam isn't what you thought he was, oh, now Trae Young and the Hawks are better than you. Oh, now you look up in the standings. What's this? Oh, the Indiana Pacers have passed you. And the New York Knicks passed you. Sure, whatever. The Knicks are the Knicks, whatever. You're in that like 7 to 8 to 9 range because Pascal Siakam is your best player and Kyle Lowry is your second best player. And Fred VanVleet is your third best player, but Fred VanVleet being your third best player without having a great star. If Siakam, Lowry, and VanVleet are your three best players, then you're like the 7th or 8th seed in the Eastern Conference. And so the window has closed for Toronto entirely, which brings us to Lowry now, where lots of expensive contracts in Toronto, lots of them expiring soon, except for Siakam and VanVleet, who are just re-signed to big contracts. The wealth of cheap players has dried up for Toronto. Their first-round pick from last year, Malachi Flynn, SDSU Aztecs fight, was literally just another version of VanVleet, who a month later you decided to re-sign after you just drafted Malachi Flynn as his replacement. And now Malachi Flynn is stuck in the G League when the Toronto Raptors are struggling with bench depth, but can't even use their first-round pick because he's literally the exact same player as Fred VanVleet, and you can't put him and Fred VanVleet on the court at the same time. But why did you draft Malachi Flynn in the first place if you were going to re-sign Fred VanVleet? This is why the Toronto Raptors are where they are now. Kyle Lowry is a free agent at the end of the season. The Toronto Raptors don't have Kyle Lowry fitting into their future plans unless he's just a nice side piece. Like, they want Fred VanVleet to be the number one guy, and they want to be able to find players who can complement what they're trying to do with Kyle Lowry. And so, or what they're trying to do with VanVleet and Siakam. And Kyle Lowry, he's 35 years old. He just doesn't fit into the long-term vision of what Toronto is doing because they're like 3 years away from ever being a competitive team again. So this is where the dilemma presents itself, where Kyle Lowry is available for trade. Toronto Raptors have a legacy play to concern themselves with. And it's okay if you want to have Kyle Lowry finish the season in Tampa Bay and join the Philadelphia 76ers next year. That's absolutely fine. But your franchise is going to be set back if you don't get anything for Kyle Lowry. At the very least, take some shots if you're going to get rid of Kyle Lowry. For example, can you get a first-round pick for Kyle Lowry? Maybe not. But if the Clippers are willing to offer you Patrick Beverley, who has long-term control, and by the way, Patrick Beverley could fit into your system further down the road, and they're willing to offer you Marcus Morris, well, maybe Marcus Morris reflects a future asset, and maybe Patrick Beverley fits in however you want to do it. But if you can get those two pieces for Kyle Lowry, it's just pieces that you can bring to the table next season when you're reevaluating where you are as a franchise. If it's easier to just let Kyle Lowry walk and just try and, like with Kawhi Leonard, replicate his 19 points a game next season by more expensive options than paying the $20 million for Kyle Lowry or whatever he's going to get, $25 million. I'm not exactly sure what Kyle Lowry will make on a contract next year, but if that's the case and they want to go the younger route, well, if you want to go the younger route, wouldn't you want to get some pieces that maybe will be on the team next, unless you're really thinking about tearing it down? But even if you are, does it really hurt to bring in some pieces? Because at the very least, you can trade them later on. This is the dilemma that the Toronto Raptors are facing. Do you want to, are the pennies on the dollar that you're going to get for Kyle Lowry worth the emotional toll of trading Kyle Lowry off of your organization? Even if Kyle Lowry is open to the trade, and by the way, would leave in free agency the next year, is the emotional side of that worth the pennies on the dollar that you're going to get for Kyle Lowry? Because what are you going to get for half a season of Kyle Lowry? You're going to get one solid NBA player, maybe a young NBA player or another contract, and maybe a couple second-round picks or one second-round pick or a throw-in piece to take a shot. Or you might end up buying out Kyle Lowry anyways. At that point, you've just dropped the ball because he's not going to be on your team anyways. The only reason you're not trading Kyle Lowry is because you really value the emotional level of these last 30 games plus a playoff run compared to the value you will recoup in return for trading Kyle Lowry to, say, the Clippers or the 76ers or the Miami Heat. And to be honest, I'm looking at what's going on right now, and it's entirely possible that the Toronto Raptors look at the situation and they decide that, well, we'll take it. We'll take the last run with Kyle Lowry, even if we have no chance of winning a championship, and we are going to ride into the sunset with this Kyle Lowry team all the way. And we're not going to win a championship. We may not make it out of the play-in round, but we're going to try and just give an emotional season, let him walk, and we'll just reconvene from there. I don't know whether it's the play or not. I genuinely don't know which direction is the best or the worst. I know the Clippers did this a few years ago with Tobias Harris, but with Tobias Harris, they had kind of decided that they were going to make a Kawhi Leonard push and kind of had verbal confirmation that Kawhi Leonard would come there. But either way, Toronto is not in the running for any big-time free agents anytime soon. They are headed towards the lottery sooner or later. Not sure when it will be. And their development has been great throughout the year, similar to San Antonio, similar to Miami. Like, Miami went through a rebuild, as Toronto is about to do, but Miami did it by drafting 10th, 13th, and 14th in the draft. Like, you don't have to tear it all down to build it back up. Miami took Justice Winslow 10th, Bam Adebayo 13th, or Bam Adebayo 14th, Tyler Hero 13th, and that was their way of rebuilding their organization. So there is not just one way to do this. And this is the difficulty that the Toronto Raptors have to have probably been looking at over the last week or so, and like, what is the direction of our franchise? And to me, I think, and again, this is like from a heartless, cold standpoint of not being a Toronto Raptors fan and not having that connection to Kyle Lowry, who will have his jersey retired. But if I put myself in that situation and I am someone who doesn't take this stuff very seriously and loves being an armchair GM, but also relates to the emotionality of being Kyle Lowry and being, well, to the best I can with being Kyle Lowry and to being a fan in these circumstances, who do you want to be entertained or do you want to like have a team that like could be intriguing? This is the interesting thing. When sports don't matter and you can play the armchair GM, I'm saying, what can I get for Kyle Lowry? And is pennies on the dollar worth watching him leave in free agency? And this is the conversation that will come to dominate the trade deadline as it comes up, because if the Lakers, the Clippers, the Heat are all the 76ers are interested in Kyle Lowry's services, it creates an interesting bidding war that maybe the Raptors can get one offer they can't refuse, or they can at least get more pennies on their dollar for whatever they can get left of Kyle Lowry in the next 2 months, and move on with whatever the next phase of your organization is going to be, because it doesn't seem like Kyle Lowry will be back. Both sides would be better off going in separate directions, and that's entirely okay. It's entirely okay for the organizations to go in different directions. It makes logical sense because Kyle Lowry's been there for 8 years. He was there when they were losing, and he came back and they became winners, and now he's leaving as they become losers again. Losers only on the record books. The Toronto Raptors are going to be a very well-run organization. They're going to figure all this out. But according to the books right now, Kyle Lowry entered as the franchise were losers, turned them into winners, along with a lot of other pieces going their way. And now he exits symbolically as the Toronto Raptors return to being losers, either at this deadline or beyond the trade deadline in, I guess free agency would be in August now, if the NBA schedules all getting pushed back a year. So in August, Kyle Lowry will be on his way out, or maybe he'll be on his way to a new location within the next 24 hours. Well, it doesn't look like there's any trades going on right now, so I was hoping maybe something would break out here within the time that we're on the air today. There will obviously be stuff tomorrow because there will be move after move after move after move. The recent news, I guess, is just Boge saying that John Collins will remain with the Hawks through the deadline, which, you know, we kind of all anticipated that at this point, even though I threw him on the list as one that, like I said, of the like eight names I listed, if one of them happens, it would be like a jarring kind of complexion of what's going on. Would jar tomorrow and probably lead the show tomorrow. By the way, 4 Eastern over on Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash, if you are interested in some deep, in-depth NBA trade deadline talk, because we will be live on the air for the NBA trade deadline about an hour after it passes. So let's talk about this Sean McVay and Jared Goff story a little bit, because I was really interested in this, and I love these in-depth journalistic stories that take you behind the scenes, per se, on what's going on in the sports landscape. And I was interested in this because, again, with Jared Goff and Sean McVay, like, we have a lot of ramblings with how the Rams go, and we kind of recognize that, you know, the Rams would be better off without Jared Goff. The Rams would be better off with another quarterback, and they got that quarterback in Matt Stafford. They made a mistake with paying Jared Goff. They acknowledged that mistake, and Sean McVay ultimately gave up an extra first-round pick just to make the problem go away. And it'll ultimately serve the benefit of the Lions as they redo a deal into – well, they rebuild their team into 2022, 2023. They'll hang on to Goff for at least 1 year as like a Brock Osweiler trial run, but they can always move Jared Goff somewhere else if things start to go his way, and Jared Goff can have his seventh different offensive coordinator in 7 different years in the NFL, which is just a tough break for a former number one overall pick. But I wanted to read a little bit from the Lindsay Theory piece from ESPN, and we'll talk more about it in depth tomorrow on the Take It Easy podcast, mostly because I'm writing about it, so we'll have a writing piece from that. But I do want to talk about this story and just read a little bit from it in a segment I like to call Reading. It's a very fun segment. We like to do it a lot on the podcast, and we're bringing it over here to the radio show, Reading with Kyle. Inside the home locker room at SoFi Stadium, standing underneath a neon-glowing Los Angeles Rams logo, Coach Sean McVay called out quarterback Jared Goff in front of players and coaches. It was a post-game scene many had never witnessed before. McVay glared in Goff's direction, shouting that he needed to play better and couldn't continue to turn the ball over. McVay didn't say the quarterback's name, but those who were there said he knew to whom McVay was talking. Minutes later, a heated McVay continued to call out Goff, but this time to reporters. The first time in 4 seasons as coach, he took aim at a player rather than putting the blame on himself after a loss. Quote, "Our quarterback has to take better care of the ball," McVay said about Goff. That week was week 12 of the 2020 season, and Goff had turned the ball over 3 times in a 23-20 loss to the NFC rival San Francisco 49ers. But McVay's frustration with the franchise quarterback had been brewing for some time. In the span of 2 seasons, which is really 16 months, by the way, that was just me improvising, routine coach and quarterback sideline squabbles turned into one-sided shouting matches, with McVay no longer holding back. Personalities that once worked harmoniously, McVay's hyper-focused drive to Goff's cool, calm, collective demeanor no longer meshed. Goff's thumb injury allowed McVay to start a different quarterback late last season. That, coupled with Matthew Stafford's request for a trade from the Lions, proved to be the end for Goff in Los Angeles. It was a startling turn of events, considering Goff won 2 NFC West division titles and an NFC championship
and helped lead the Rams to Super Bowl 53. For those accomplishments, he was rewarded with a four-year, $134 million extension, including record-breaking $110 million guaranteed, just 16 months before the trade. When you look back, or I'll quote McVay, when you look back on the 4 years we did have together, there's a lot of time you can smile on. I would say there's a lot of things that when I self-reflect, I certainly wish I was better for him in some instances. The trade, and this is just, I'm just going to correlate some things here, that the trade came together within 24 hours, and it was a move few could have predicted despite knowing the Rams quarterback situation would be different than the previous 4 years. And Sean McVay, Matt Stafford, McVay's fiance, and Stafford's wife were all vacationing in Cabo when that trade was consummated. So that seems to be a rather interesting predicament to find yourself in there. And so one of the reasons that the Rams were in this position in the first place was just because they gave Goff the contract because they were afraid of mega paydays for like Patrick Mahomes and Deshaun Watson that came last offseason. So they locked up Jared Goff early on. So here's the story. A day after the deal was announced, Goff smiled about his future with McVay. "He's joked that I'm stuck with him. I told him I think I'm okay with that," Goff said. "It will be a good marriage. I'm happy to be with him for a long time." However, in the two seasons that follow, the Rams' offense steadily declined, going from third in scoring to 12th to 22nd by 2020, along with declines in Goff's production. Along with it, the question began percolating inside the Rams building. Did we make a mistake? And so one of the interesting parts that the story goes on to talk about is the communication breakdown between Goff and McVay, where Jared Goff was so sold on the idea that – I'm sorry, Sean McVay was so sold on the idea that it was Goff's shortcomings that were preventing him from – or leading to offensive declines. And Goff felt like he was being micromanaged by Sean McVay. And so this created this interesting tension. And one of the lines they talked about was that Jared Goff didn't develop into someone who could – he couldn't – Jared Goff couldn't be a person without a ton of people around him that could be amazing. And the same thing happened for Carson Wentz, and his development ended up being stunted because of it. And the Rams were in such a win-now mode that, yeah, they failed Jared Goff quite a bit, not to mention the fact that everybody in the NFL wanted to copy what the Rams were doing. So that ends up a situation where Goff has Jeff Fisher in his first year in the league. Then he has Matt LaFleur, in his second year. Then McVay is the de facto OC, but Zach Taylor is the quarterback coach who's acting as a bridge between Jared Goff and Sean McVay, and Shane Waldron and Zach Robinson as well. Taylor leaves, then it's just McVay having direct conversation with Jared Goff as the offensive coordinator, and then they hire Kevin O'Connell as the offensive coordinator in 2020. And now Jared Goff will go to play with Anthony Lynn in 2021. All of that is to say that the Rams did not really do right by Jared Goff. Not that Jared Goff was an excellent quarterback either way, but I think the Rams definitely made a mistake when they evaluated and said Jared Goff right now is a top five quarterback and he's in year three. I think that was a pretty profound mistake to make that evaluation when they did. And so the Rams are left in this interesting position where they were sitting there with their quarterback and McVay was just, he felt forced into a quarterback situation. And I was saying throughout the season, if you listen to McVay's press conferences, he is over Jared Goff's you-know-what. And it ended up being the case. Like, as soon as they had a chance to move off from them, he did. And not to confuse with Les Snead, the GM, and McVay, but Les Snead recognized that this was untenable as well. Now, they don't talk about this in the story, but Les Snead was the same guy, and Sean McVay gave his sign-off on it that when they gave Goff the four-year extension, McVay signed off on it. So within those 17 months was when everything broke down. The fourth year, everything started going sour, and then by 2020, McVay was just over it. He just, like, Goff can't do it. Like, he just – the coaching for McVay turned from here's how we're going to construct Jared Goff, and I wish I could find the point about it. Here it is. I want to read this quote about it from, like, everything breaking down between McVay and Goff. Quote, ultimately, the merger between the type A football hyper-personality of McVay and the laid-back Goff didn't work. Spend enough time around McVay and you'll notice some common refrains. Among them, quote, consistency is the truest measure of performance. Throughout the 2020 season, McVay harped on Goff's need to improve. Quote, consistency is the biggest thing. I know it's like a broken record, but it is the truth, McVay said when asked what he wanted to see from Goff through the final quarter of the 2019 regular season. He was good this year, a team source said about Goff, except when he was awful. Goff ended up passing for 3,900 yards, 20 touchdowns, his fewest since his rookie season, with interceptions the following season. Work ethic wasn't an issue. Goff put in the hours. It was a matter of understanding, diagnosing, and applying what was coached. Goff struggled to recognize coverage disguises and didn't consistently identify coverage post-snap as the play developed. When a defense ran cover zero with no safeties deep, his decision-making process often didn't happen quickly enough to hit the big play. Quote, as a quarterback, you can't lose games, a team source said. We just need him to manage it and do his part. The Rams had the top defense in the league, and that just ate at Sean McVay that they couldn't keep up the success on offense because McVay, who was the offensive genius, that was his thing, and he felt like he had to call every play perfectly for Goff. And everyone's telling you, look at how smart you are as a coach, and he absolutely is an amazing coach. Love me some Sean McVay. But Sean McVay, at a certain point, they talked about he either just stopped caring about Goff, he gave up on Goff, or he just didn't care about eroding Jared Goff's confidence. And this is just a part of what Sean McVay was going for. It's just this is how it's going to be, and this is how we're going to operate and not kill each other. And so this is the Jared Goff, Sean McVay dynamic at its most cynical. It was the consistency that became a problem. And so far too often, the wheels kept falling off and McVay felt that he had to micromanage Goff, and Goff felt like there was a lack of trust and communication there. And the 49ers game in week 12 was where a lot of things came crashing down, where the formula had been portrayed. You know how to beat the Rams. With a lot of blitz packages, the 49ers had always matched up well against the Rams. We talked about that all season. They matched up really well against the Rams. They beat them four straight times during the season. And so McVay couldn't hide his frustrations. McVay was either like unaware, or this is actually a direct quote, by the way. Quote, McVay was either unaware or disinterested in protecting Jared's confidence. And the worst thing for Jared was when Sean got a taste of John Walford, because John Walford ends up being close to what McVay is looking for. And Walford arrived early during the week's first, or here's, I'm going to read some more from this about John Walford. Walford arrived early during the week for practices, 6:30 a.m., and stayed late even when he was on the practice squad. Quote, just a different animal, a league source said. Quote, he's addicted like McVay, a team source said. The energy around the practice facility shifted when Walford took over. It was just kind of an opportunity for John to breathe some life into the offense with his athleticism and intelligence, a team source said. Some players were excited about Walford starting, not necessarily because they didn't like Goff, but because they thought the mobile Walford provided a spark. Walford overcame an interception on his first pass to throw for 231 yards in an 18-7 win over Arizona while rushing for a team-leading 57 yards. Which, by the way, isn't overly impressive. 231 yards plus the rushing yards is pretty damn good, but not overly impressive. With a wild card playoff in Seattle up next, McVay decided early in the week Walford would start, despite having yet to see Goff's post-surgery recovery progress. Goff insisted he would be ready to play. But McVay's decision was final. explaining a game plan would need to be installed to prepare Walford, which, okay, I believe you. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, sarcasm, sarcasm. Quote, functionality was going to be an issue with the thumb, a team source said, but I think it was probably that combination of, holy cow, we just saw John play, we got in rhythm, we kind of had a new game plan. And the Arizona to Seattle weeks, those were our best weeks of practice, another team source said. The confidence of the team was high. And then John Walford gets hurt. Jared Goff comes in as the backup, and he proved, despite limited opportunity to practice, he could lead the Rams to a playoff victory, closing out an upset at Seattle. Despite Goff's improbable efforts versus Seattle, questions again began brewing about who would start ahead of a divisional playoff at Green Bay. Walford ended up being ruled out late in the week, so Goff would end up starting. But they're saying here that had it not been for Walford's injury, several sources say McVay would have started him against the Packers. When asked if Walford would have started had he been available, McVay avoided the question. McVay was ready to make a Super Bowl run with John Walford over Jared Goff because he had the number one defense in the league, Cam Akers was emerging as a strong running back, and John Walford was just a different kind of guy compared to Jared Goff. He just didn't have the physical tools that Jared Goff did. And so the desire for Walford wasn't quite unanimous, but that was ultimately the call was McVay's, as was the call to have Jared Goff be traded. A lot of that call was on Sean McVay, and Sean McVay made the call that we are going to move off of our guy. And, well, I guess technically the guy he inherited, I mean, Les Snead drafted him, but the guy that he inherited, and this is the interesting place that they find themselves in because the Rams were over whatever was going on between Sean McVay and Jared Goff. And again, like I said off the top, they gave away a first-round pick to make it go away. That extra 2023 first-round pick, that wasn't really part of the Stafford trade because they gave up a first-round pick, a third-round pick for Matthew Stafford. When the asking price example for Carolina was willing to offer the number 8 overall pick and the 5th rounder. So that extra first-round pick that they got in 2023, that was for them to take Jared Goff off their hands, like a Brock Osweiler type of trade. Take the contract, give him a chance to develop in your system. If not, do what you will. We just need you to take Jared Goff, and we will give you a first-round pick to take Jared Goff off of our hands and take the money, and we'll accept the dead cap hit for 1 year and be rid of Jared Goff for the next 3 years, 4 years of that contract, and maybe just maybe we'll catch a little spark with Matthew Stafford. So it created this interesting bubbling dynamic between Sean McVay and Jared Goff, the Rams, and the remainder of that organization. And so, lo and behold, they end up going in their separate directions after all this time, and it seems ultimately in the end that it was Sean McVay's call to make that move. And again, I cannot recommend the story enough. It's on ESPN. Lindsay Theory writes it, but you can pretty much find it on the homepage of ESPN at this point. It's really well-done journalism around the Jared Goff, Sean McVay storyline, and I would encourage you reading all the way through it because I spent an hour not just going through it, not quite an hour there, but also just writing about it, which we'll finish writing about it, and it'll be part of tomorrow's podcast, which you can subscribe to wherever it is that you get your podcast. So still nothing in the NBA trade universe, and we have 10 minutes left here on the Take It Easy podcast live on Open Talk Radio 313, The Flash. There's not really too much going on in the world other than March Madness, which, March Madness is going to be really interesting in the next few days because all of a sudden, I mean, there's lots of fun storylines, but there's still, you know, some of the great teams that are going to keep everyone close and watching their TV. For example, Evan Mobley and USC, they play Oregon in the next game. By the way, death taxes and Dana Altman pulling up to the Sweet 16. Like, Oregon just always makes the Sweet 16. It does not matter what seed they are. Oregon is making it to the Sweet 16. Anyways, so Evan Mobley is going to be someone who is going to attract a fantastic audience for the next few days. Cade Cunningham would have done some of that. Obviously, Cade Cunningham got bounced from the tournament, but he would have done a lot of the attracting, and it would have been interesting to watch that play out. And I'm fascinated by that matchup, no question. We're still going to get some of the top ones with, obviously, Gonzaga is going to go up against, not Creighton, right? Did Creighton win? No. Who is the four seed in that region? They did beat Ohio. So Creighton against Gonzaga. You've got Baylor against Villanova. That's going to be an interesting matchup. I think Baylor will win, but still you've got the best teams that will keep advancing through that region. And then you've got some of the craziness. You've got Syracuse against Houston. You've got an Oral Roberts game that will get people excited. It'll get me excited at the very least. How about Oral Roberts? Like, shout out to Oral Roberts. We talked about them last week on the radio show as we were watching March Madness. Shout out to Oral Roberts, man. What a fantastic run that they've been on. Like, they were an upset that was genuinely good compared to Texas, who just, like, Abilene Christian played poorly and still beat Texas, which is absolutely amazing. But shout out to Oral Roberts again. They are going to the Sweet 16, ladies and gentlemen. They'll play Arkansas, whom I had advancing to the Elite Eight out of that region. So win or lose in this one, I'll either have Arkansas moving on to the Elite Eight, or I'll have Oral Roberts going to the Elite Eight in the greatest run I have ever seen ever with a 15 seed going to the Elite Eight. That would just be amazing to see. So you'll get that craziness. You'll get Michigan and Florida State. You're 1-5s, you're 1-4s. We mentioned Gonzaga, Creighton, Baylor, Villanova, Michigan, Florida State. UCLA is going to play Bama. Syracuse is going to play Houston. But then you can get your craziness on. You can get your Loyola Chicago versus Oregon State. You can get your Oral Roberts versus Arkansas. You can get your Oregon USC and watch Evan Mobley. There are going to be some really fun games, some really interesting Cinderella-type stories, most of them coming out of that Midwest region where chaos was just about to break out had Houston lost after Illinois also lost. Houston could still make the Final Four and ruin it, but at the very least, either Loyola Chicago or Oregon State is going to make it to the Elite Eight, and who the hell doesn't want to watch Loyola Chicago or Oregon State make it to the Elite Eight? And by the way, shout out to Scooter Magruder. I know he's not listening, but I love listening to his stuff. And I was just laughing at the idea that Colorado, when they lost to Florida State, would basically be like, so was Georgetown just not that good? Is that kind of just where we're at this point? Georgetown wasn't as good as we thought they were. So anyways, yeah, that creates an interesting situation, dynamic, parallel, et cetera, where Oregon State and Loyola Chicago could have an epic game to decide who goes to the Final Four, or even funnier, Syracuse versus either Oregon State or Loyola Chicago. If they can upend Houston, Alabama, good for you. I mean, you're going to play UCLA. You're probably going to beat UCLA. It's been a good ride for Alabama so far. You beat Maryland, you beat Iona, you got UCLA, and you're going to get one of these tougher teams in the Sweet Six or the Elite Eight. So it's been a nice little ride for Alabama, not having to play any team that is not a double-digit seed so far, which, by the way, hasn't been totally secure for everyone who we're talking about here. Like, lots of people are losing to double-digit seeds left and right. So I don't know. It's been interesting to watch all of this play out. I am super pumped for some March. Let's see. We got 5 minutes left here. Is there any last news on the NBA trade spectrum that we can dig into here? Aaron Gordon may be having second thoughts on his potential trade. To be honest, like I said, I put Aaron Gordon in the category of it would be shocking if they're traded by tomorrow, because Aaron Gordon isn't an impending free agent. So if you don't get the offer that you're looking for, you can just stash Aaron Gordon. But Orlando, I think Aaron Gordon is recognizing that he might not be traded by tomorrow, even if he's thinking of going to Boston, where Boston has a trade exception where you use it or lose it, which I think would be perfect. If they went after Harrison Barnes, I don't know if they're going to make that move, but there's just a lot that you're hanging your hat on at this point if you're the Orlando Magic and you're Aaron Gordon, because, yeah, you could get traded with Aaron Gordon, but Orlando has a pretty good chance of hanging on to you past the deadline because your contract doesn't expire. So, yeah, he requested a trade, and I've been saying forever, Aaron Gordon needs to go to the Denver Nuggets. It's just a match made in heaven, but that is not happening right now. I anticipate Aaron Gordon will be hung on to past the deadline. This will be really funny if Aaron Gordon gets traded like 30 minutes after this podcast concludes, but he's on that list of guys where I'm just like, yeah, probably not going to get traded, but it would be interesting to watch it happen one way or another. And then there's just the smaller guys. Victor Oladipo is not really a small guy. He's kind of just in the middle, but he should get traded. Markkanen, I don't know what the Bulls are doing at this point. We've done our series on rebuilding the Chicago Bulls, which you can check out on our podcast with Jason Pat of the Cash Considerations podcast, where we rebuilt the Chicago Bulls and turned some things around. But they can always send Lowry into restricted free agency next year and work out a sign-and-trade. So, again, no pressure to move Lauri Markkanen, no pressure to move Terry Rozier or Vooch, any of those guys. Even Lonzo Ball would hit restricted free agency next offseason, so they can wait and see what the offers are on the table. But Lonzo Ball will at least at this point be affordable for people who maybe don't want an Eric Bledsoe or Kyle Lowry, because if, per se, you're the Clippers, to get Kyle Lowry, you'd have to part with Patrick Beverley and Marcus Morris to make such a trade happen. So maybe you don't want to part with that much if you're either the Clippers or the Heat or whoever else may be in the running. Go get Alonzo Ball. It's a cheaper option, and maybe you can improve that point guard play. And if you're Miami, you can get Alonzo Ball rather easily. Just flip him for Kendrick Nunn, and you can go from there and fill out the rest of the trade with whatever pieces you want to add, a second-round pick or anything left that Miami has. Maybe like one of those Silvas or a Gabe Vincent or whatever the Miami Heat still have to offer. I don't even know what they have at this point. But they did get Trevor Ariza, and maybe that's all Miami's going to do in their pursuit of getting bounced in the first round by the Boston Celtics. Maybe that's all Miami's got at this point is, we can beat the Boston Celtics in the first round, and we can either beat Boston in the first round and just be happy with that and get bounced in the second round, or we'll get bounced in the first round, because honestly, that's the best you can expect from Miami at this point, even knowing that they're coming off the NBA Finals last year. Best thing for Miami, hope you get bounced in the second round. That will still be a hugely successful season. Why? Because you need a player better than Jimmy Butler to take down the Brooklyn Nets or the Milwaukee Bucks, except when they took down the Milwaukee Bucks last year. But I still attest that had Giannis stayed healthy, there's a damn good chance the Milwaukee Bucks would have won that series. People forget that the Bucks lost the first two games of the series and lost Giannis at the very beginning of Game 3, where they were beating the Miami Heat. So, ladies and gentlemen, the Bucks could have won that series against the Heat had Giannis. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for stopping into the Take It Easy radio show here on Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash. We will be back at it tomorrow with our NBA trade deadline live show. We're live no matter what, but it'll be just an hour after the NBA trade deadline has passed. So we will have some news and notes to react to throughout the day. Again, follow us on Instagram, Take It Easy Podcast, or Comical Sports Memes. And follow Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash on Instagram and Facebook as well. And with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, have an amazing day. Have an amazing week. However and whenever you may be listening, we appreciate you stopping in. And as always, take it easy. We will talk to you again tomorrow. Have a great day.